Hello, and welcome to History Reconsidered, a podcast dedicated to taking a deep dive in historical issues and events and relating them to the modern world. I'm your host, Jarrett Stebbin, and I'm joined by my co-host, Samantha Mitra. On this week's episode, we'll be continuing our series on World War II with a discussion about the rise of Nazi Germany. And of course, we had to do an episode that just focuses on Germany. You really can't have a World War II series without it. I think to start off here, in the last week's episode, we talked about book recommendations, and I suggested that especially after you started with Trotsky and Mussolini in the previous 2 weeks, that you wouldn't necessarily go for the Mustachioed Man's book this week. Are you going to suggest Mein Kampf as one of your go-to books at the end of this episode?
I mean, say what you will about the ethos. No, I think that's a valid criticism. Look, I mean, from a historian's point of view, I'd absolutely suggest people to read that book, but that is not going to be one of my book suggestions today. It's also a really badly written book compared to Trotsky and Mussolini, who were, for all their faults, you know, they were actually really good writers. Hitler wasn't a good writer. It was just a you know, weird guy at a weird time. This is a great episode. Yeah.
It is, and I think to kind of really seriously start this episode, to talk about Nazi Germany and the rise of Nazi Germany, I think of course you have to begin with the end of World War I, with the events that took place in the immediate aftermath of the war. That led to not even a decade, really, of peace within Germany before a system that was kind of created as a republic, the Weimar Republic, went back into, I would say, a more vicious form of totalitarianism, more vicious than anything that preceded it, certainly Imperial Germany, and led to the great calamity of the middle of the 20th century. Can you talk about Germany at the end of World War One, the state it was in?
Yeah, I think that's it's a good point that the rise of Nazis changed not just the world in ways when it comes to politics or philosophy, but also artistically. When we think of a totalitarian country, there is nothing that tops that. It's the peak. It's the most, you know, really good-looking people with extremely well-dressed, well-articulated people and very high culture and extreme high modernism and, you know, great uniforms, but also the most mechanized, destructive brutality of in the entire human history that you can find. The complete heartless way of treating politics and the extreme discrimination and hierarchy, the very world, you know, the worldview, which is like black and white, you know, you have either civilized people or you have vermins, and you know, what you can do with vermins is you have to like cull them like they're animals. It's absolutely incredible, and it shaped our society and it shaped our culture, and to this day, you know, that's all people can think of. Oh, you know, you're Hitler, this is Munich, you're it's the Nazis. The Star Wars, you know, the villains dress in a way which reminds people of stormtroopers. You know, it's fundamentally, you see the war in Ukraine on both sides, on the Russians to some less extent and the Ukrainians to some more. They're having tattoos and uniforms and call lines and you know, name signs and all that kind of stuff, which is related to the Nazis. It changed human history. It's the most pivotal political movement that we saw, to the great credit or discredit of Germans, it was done very efficiently. you know, compared to the other people in the entire world, the Germans, when they do something, they do it really well. So they actually did Nazism extremely well. The only difference is it was horrific, and they gave it their all.
They certainly did, and it's of course the thing that I think is maybe the most horrifying thing about the Nazis is that it seems like the German civilization is such an advanced, one could say progressive civilization. I mean, you talk about the developments in the 19th century, the modernization of the German state. It was looked to for various, changes in, modern health insurance, national health insurance. And it was looked at as a very progressive country, one that had when you talk about the countries of the world, is among the most advanced. It had some phenomenal universities. It was seen as an enlightened country. I think that's what makes Nazi Germany so horrific, is that you see plenty of barbarism throughout human history, plenty of darkness, plenty of evil. But to see a modern society plunge into the depths of such evil, you know, it kind of debunks this idea. I mean, I think there's this attitude sometimes that, well, bigotry or anti-Semitism, it's all stemmed on ignorance. It's just ignorance. And I think to a certain extent, Nazi Germany, which is funny because I think sometimes ignorant people use the slander of, oh, you're a Nazi or a fascist quite frequently. But I think Nazi Germany kind of in some ways proves that evil is not just committed by the ignorant or the stupid or the simple, that this can be conducted by the very intelligent, by the efficient, by those who are at the forefront of progress. And I think that's what makes them so horrifying. That's why I think they are now the boogeyman of Western civilization, because there's this idea that at any time, well, hey, a people could become just like that. Now, I don't think that Western peoples are suddenly going to become Nazis, and I think they are very much tied to a certain people at a certain time. But it does show that, you know, a people can plunge themselves into evil in such a way, and into totalitarianism, where at one point there was philosophy and knowledge and freedom. Those things can go away and become something quite vicious. So I think that the question is, you know, where did this come from in Germany? Was this something that is ingrained in the German culture? Is it because of their experiences at the end of World War One, their blame of what they thought was traitors within their midst, of course, blaming Jews and other traitors that they thought were had betrayed them during the war? You know, what was it that caused this descent into evil?
Yeah, that's a good question. And also, to go back to your earlier point, I mean, the fact that people get so astounded when they get to know that Nazism was fundamentally a progressive and modernist movement is just how horrific our own system of education is. You know, I mean, fundamentally, both fascists and Nazis hated liberalism, not because liberalism was opposed to fascism or Nazism, but because they thought liberalism doesn't really let you go as far as you need to go in pursuit of modernity. Everything that the Nazis and the fascists did, they did in the name of progress. They took the scientific idea of humanity and race and all of these things to its ultimate highest point. Abortion, euthanasia, you know, every transgenderism, you know, the medical, the fact that you have to force vaccination on a bunch of people because in the name of progress, the fact that you can do medical procedures without asking anyone or taking their liberty. They thought that liberalism was a hindrance to that liberalism gives too much right to individuals. And that's not really, to them, liberalism was not a modernist progressive movement. It was it was keeping you back towards from moving towards complete progress. But fundamentally, after the First World War, so the end of the First World War wasn't really good for Germany, obviously, for a little bit of understatement, I guess. The Germans had no discipline by the time the Americans started pouring in. They knew that they're losing the war. Their offensive lines have, you know, stopped moving from 1917 onwards. The tank changed the dynamic of infantry movements in France. And then obviously the Americans joined the war, which meant the Germans were like completely hopeless. Like there's no way they could. They had a little bit of window when they knocked out Russia in the east and before the Americans joined in. And they thought they had this ultimate massive push and they almost managed to knock Britain and France out. But through enormous personal sacrifice of both British and French troops, they couldn't. And then when the moment the Americans joined in with all their, you know, manpower and their mechanized movement, the war was lost. It was Germany against three major powers and their continental forces and their colonial forces. There were Indians, for example, fighting in Italy. Like Germany had no such, you know, colonial reserves to tap into. So they knew that the war was lost. Their lines were already broken. And that created three problems. On one hand, Germany never really had a system of governance where people had any choice, you know? So, so the moment, so when discipline breaks out in that kind of situation, it could become two things. One, there is no democratic setup to channel the rage of the political masses and shape it towards, you know, growth. So you have a bifurcation of the conservative, the nobles, the feudal, you know, power. All the German military officers, for example, were from nobility and aristocracy. They were all, you know, with a tied middle name, with massive, you know, hereditary blood. They lost power, but they also didn't lose their political position. So in one hand, they were like, they were dormant in a way where they had enormous amount of political influence, but no real political power because the, you know, the country has turned republic. People are not listening to you. But the people who are not listening to you don't really have money or manpower or land to actually change anything. So it's kind of like a divided society where the conservatives and the reactionary forces were waiting for a power to give them, you know, put them back in power. There was no setup, there was no idea of the English, the Anglo-American sense of liberty. So they had no concept of rights in a way that the British or the Americans knew. That obviously reflected in freedom without responsibility. So it was like utter chaos when it comes to the Weimar Republic. The cultural scene of the Weimar Republic was horrific. There were experimentations going on in people when it comes to transgenderism, which no one really talks about these days because it might bring back like bad parallels with our modern times. But it was a bad place to be. And finally, the Treaty of Versailles was so destructive to German industry that it was punitive in a way that, one, Germany had suffered because of its economy, but also there was no way of Germany getting back. Lord Lansdowne, to his credit, opposed that and said that, like, you know, Germany has lost the war, but we don't need to put it out of the balance of great powers. It's at the end of the day, a civilized country. You cannot push a spring to the point where it breaks. So give it space to have normal trade relations. But France, obviously, understandably, was opposed to it. Britain, to some extent, was opposed to it. And the German, the neighbors of Germany, the Austro-Hungarian Empire was gone. So there were like various small powers which had enormous number of German people living in those countries for no fault of their own, by the way, but who were outside the of German influence, but who were very much in support of Germany. So all of these forces combined made the country a very volatile situation. Would you like to talk about some of the Weimar parallels with us when it comes to culture and art, won't you?
Yeah, I would. I do think it's interesting in discussing Germany as a, in some ways, very modern people. They still didn't have a long tradition of self-government that you see with the Anglo-American powers. I mean, the United States was literally, before it was conceived as an actual country, had a tradition of self-government that I think just wasn't the norm in Germany, even at that advanced state. And I think there were even suggestions during the Weimar era of a return to essentially some kind of limited monarchy, much like the British system, essentially, that the republic just wasn't working out for the German people in the way it was for the United States, that some kind of mixed constitutional system would have actually been better than the pure republican system. And I don't think that's entirely crazy to think that. I mean, you can even look at British history, that the history of republics didn't work out so well after the rise of Oliver Cromwell and the failure of the British Republic, you could say. So I don't think it's crazy, this idea that a change to a more even monarchical kind of system, a limited monarchy, might have been better than what you actually had with the Weimar Republic, which I think that there was a general lack of confidence and faith in the system. I think people simply didn't believe that this thing was sustainable. I think they saw a lot of cultural degeneracy around them at the time. They saw weak leadership, that while Hindenburg, who was the president of the Republic, was certainly a war hero. He had been a hero on the Eastern Front during World War I and was nationally recognized. He was certainly not an energetic man ready to lead a great country. He was already in his 80s. You know, you want to talk about a little bit parallels. You know, you had a man who was very much at the end of his career and was would have very happily, I think, retired, was kind of put in place as a kind of symbol for the whole country. But you know, you could see this peeling away in a culture that, especially when you talk about the turbulent 1920s, where you have at the end of the 20s a terrible depression that hits the country, is that people were looking for answers. They weren't getting it from the Weimar Republic. The world was a very troubled place. They saw Germany as a country that was denied its greatness before World War I, that could still be great. That they didn't see that in the Weimar Republic. They saw decadence, they saw failure, and they saw weakness. And I think that just simply that opened the path to something like what eventually became Nazi Germany. Obviously, they had a man in Adolf Hitler who was committed to fundamentally changing Germany into something else, who had a vision for that, quite evil. But I think you see that the pieces of the weakness, really, the fragility of the Weimar Republic years before it actually ended up collapsing, so that when it did collapse, it didn't seem like anybody really lamented its failure.
Yeah, and also there was no sense of coherence when it comes to the governing power of the Weimar Republic as well. I mean, on one hand, you had like the Social Democrats who were, you know, on the other hand, you had the communists who were extremely, extremely dangerous. Like some of the, talking of our Antifa of our current times, it fundamentally rose in the Weimar Republic. The anti-fascist action was a left-wing bloc, which used to go and do street fights in the, that's one of the reasons why every time we see like street violence in the US, we kind of think of how Weimarian the situation is. But also on the other hand, there are like small things like the new objectivism movement when it comes to art was very different than anything Europe had seen before. So on one hand, you have Britain, which is a traditionally liberal empire. And, you know, and especially in the 1920s and 30s, you know, there was not much difference between the subjects in the far off East, where you could have like, South African or Indian barristers and you know, people who are there in London in the equal society. And in America, for example, there was this huge changes happening both in production and capacity, and also jazz and all the kind of things that the artistic things that's coming up. Weimar tried to incorporate all of those things in a very traditional German society, and to the people who lost war, it felt like a kind of like colonialism. So some of the artistic influence that was coming to Germany at that point of time, the more traditional conservative Germans thought that, oh, this is you know, destructive of our culture. I mean, again, there are hundreds of parallels that we see today when it comes to, you know, the Great War on Terror in Iraq, and we tried to like change Afghan and Iraqi society, and you know, we instantly it resulted in a backlash. And kind, some of the, you know, similar dynamics could be seen in Germany as well. But also, politically, it was very fraught. Like they were like, there was this constant fighting going on the streets. I mean, that the German conservatives were genuinely worried about the rise of left wing after the Soviet Union. Like they knew what a template. I mean, at that point of time, a communist revolution was not just out of the blue. There is already a template of something like that happening in a great power. People in France and Britain, even though they were opposed to the Nazis and opposed to how Germany rearming and Germany should rearm, they were also extremely opposed to having a Soviet Union right next door. They were opposed. Their elite class were opposed to having, you know, communists and people just ransacking and taking properties away and killing kings and queens and all that kind of stuff. The German nobility, obviously, the entire, you know, Central European nobility was worried that there would be a revolution in their streets. And that also was a fertile ground for a right-wing dissent.
Yeah, I think whenever you see a society that appears to be in chaos, you risk that kind of reaction. You don't know where the reaction is going to come from. Now, it may be a positive reaction in the sense that somebody steps in and restores order and clamps down the crime and chaos, and liberty is restored, because you can't have a society that has liberty if you have that, if you have those things, and people's rights aren't being protected. People are being beaten in the streets with no recourse, with no justice. I think, you know, we're seeing a little bit of that taking place now in the West, especially in the United States, a lot of cities where you see crime getting out of control. You see this in other countries in South America where crime's out of control, and you see a reaction that in some cases is very much desired. Like you see in El Salvador right now, a crackdown on gangs that essentially were running the country. You have a government that comes in and breaks up the gangs, and people are generally pretty happy when they don't have to be afraid when they walk outside. In some cases, that can turn out very well. In other cases, that can be exploited by what ultimately becomes a dictatorship. That, I guess, the key is to not allow your society to become that way to begin with, to understand that a society in which people don't see justice taking place, where they don't have any faith in the authorities to keep them safe and to adhere to that justice, you are ripe for an end of the genuine liberties that you have. And I think that you did see that in German society in the lead up to the rise of Nazism. I think there's no question. And so that when the Nazis did finally take power, yes, many opposed it. It was never, in its early stages, was never particularly popular within Germany. It was always a minority party. But then once it started to gain steam, there really wasn't much opposition in the end. I mean, that's especially as a charismatic political figure like Adolf Hitler seemed to have victory after victory on the international political stage. There were the arguments to stop him became weaker and weaker within German society.
So before we move to Hitler, I mean, I would like to say two quotes by a person who would be considered phenomenal when it comes to the politics and the philosophy of Nazi Germany. Even though, absurdly, he was not a Nazi when the thing started. He was fundamentally a critique of liberal democracy. Carl Schmitt, his two famous quotes was, the first one was that there cannot be a genuine democracy when it comes to a situation like Weimar Republic, when they have like too many stakeholders. So his quote was, every actual democracy rests on the principle that not only are equals equal, but unequals will not be treated equally. Democracy requires, therefore, first, homogeneity, and second, if the need arises, elimination or eradication of heterogeneity. And the second quote was, the exception is more interesting than the rule. The rule proves nothing. The exception proves everything. Sovereign is he who decides on the exception. Now, the reason that's interesting is the first debate is something that we're having now. If you have a society which you want to keep a democracy, and then you have people who are not aligned to the dominant culture or, you know, to the dominant worldview or lifestyle, then you risk a situation where they would not be assimilated enough in the country, and therefore be in a situation where, one, either the country dissolves, or two, you have someone in power who forcefully makes the entire thing, you know, coherent. So that is obviously it's his way of saying, like, you know, fundamentally liberal democracies is doomed, because the more liberal you are, it's completely free, and therefore there would be no coherence, and someone would just come and be dictatorial and bring coherence. But the second point he mentioned is that the exception is always interesting to the rule. It's fundamentally the person who can decide on the exception is the ultimate arbiter of power in history. What do you think of Carl Schmitt's ideas compared to our times? Like, was he onto something?
Yeah, I think he was onto something. I think he was. It was interesting. It was reading an article recently. I think it was, might have been in National Affairs. It might have been some other publication that was basically saying, I was using this example of El Salvador, and was saying that essentially, oh, this is an attack on democracy, what's happening in El Salvador. Isn't that nice that you have gotten rid of the crime, but this is an attack on democracy? And unfortunately, one, I think we now have a very warped view of what democracy even is. I think this idea that liberalism and democracy go hand in hand, I think, is rather silly. It's not true. A democracy can very much not be liberalism at all.
That's exactly right.
And so I think that there's this idea, and unfortunately, the even the word democracy just now has been boiled down to things I like, or it means liberalism. In some cases, it actually means something more akin to the deep state or something that's not very democratic whatsoever. There's, in fact, just the opposite of democracy. So what I would say is that in these cases where you have somebody complaining that a restoration of order means the end of democracy, I think you really need to observe and think about what undergirds that. I mean, if you really are to have a free republic, you know, what are the attributes that are necessary for that? These things don't just happen magically. The reason the United States succeeded was not simply because it had a constitution or simply because the American people said they like democracy. It's because you had a long tradition, a culture accustomed to self-government. You had a long tradition of respecting rights, including the right to free speech and many others that were ingrained and taught and passed down within generations. You had a long cultural and constitutional tradition that even preceded the formation of the government that was nurtured and fostered. Plus, you had the temporizing aspects of Christianity and the kind of Christian nature of the American Republic. And these things created the stability and the kind of special, unique character of the United States. And I think that, you know, when you talk about, oh, democracy, this, you have to understand that, you know, these things don't just happen magically out of nowhere. You can't just transplant the U.S. Constitution, dump into Afghanistan and think that, well, it's going to be just like the United States. It's going to be a free country. I don't think that's true. And I think that that's what oftentimes these, you know, some of the social commentators in our day and maybe in previous times don't quite understand. It was certainly the case with Weimar Germany, where you have a country that has a constitution. It has what you might call democracy. And it ended up being one of the most, maybe the most vicious totalitarian regime in human history. And that's the product of it. You know, you can say that you want democracy until you're blue in the face, but unless you can produce a system where, you know, people believe that they're going to have their rights protected, where they believe they have faith and confidence in the system, and they have the cultural traits to uphold that, you won't get that. You'll get something very different.
I'm glad you took it up. I mean, I have this paper clip in front of me. It's from the Associated Press in from the 1920s. And the title of this news is "Nazis Plan to Kill Incurables to End Pain. German Religious Groups Oppose Move." And you see what's happening in Canada, and you see what's happening when it comes to "In the Name of a Sister Dying." And you're like, the quote in this paper is like, "The Catholic newspaper Germania hastened to observe the Catholic that binds the, you know, conscience of its followers not to accept the methods of shortening the suffering of incurables. In Lutheran circles too, life is regarded as something that God alone can take." It's absolutely incredible, you know, how the parallels that we see today. But also on the other hand, like the symbolism that the Nazis used, like whether it comes to Hakenkreuz or the Sonnenrad or the even the swastika, they were not Christian symbols. They were all pagan symbols. All every single one of them. You know, it's absolutely, it's, they were like old Teutonic symbols when it comes to their way of enhancing modernity was a very pagan worldview.
Yeah, it definitely was a pagan worldview. I think in many ways anti-Christian. It was Western but not Christian. I think there was an attempt, and this was very much the case in Nazi Germany, to kind of revive the old Roman pagan tradition in continental Europe. That a lot of the symbolism, obviously, was the salute. The Nazi salute is based on the Roman salute. I mean, a lot of the, you could say, the aesthetics of the Third Reich were adopted and adapted from what they saw as a return to a pagan West, essentially an anti-Christian West. And a lot of the opponents of Nazi Germany, including Winston Churchill, often made that clear distinction. I mean, Churchill in his speeches, I think it's always notable, he doesn't refer to the West, he refers to Christendom specifically. And of course, the West simply means Western Christendom when you talk about its history. But that was an important distinction because he saw what Nazi Germany was becoming and what Hitler stood for is very deeply anti-Christian. It's against that Christian culture that had undergirded Western societies for over 1,000 years, what Nazi Germany was undoing in the name of a perverted science, a dark perverted science. And I think that that's, again, it's, you know, we had this discussion about Williams Jennings Bryan a few weeks ago. And when we talked about, you know, basically eugenics and what William James Bryan was against, you know, he was mocked in his own day for being against Darwinism. But the thing he was actually most horrified was about social Darwinism, which very much had a lot of connections to Nazi Germany. So I think that there is absolutely, this idea that Nazi Germany was somehow a traditional regime, or that it was somehow linked to Christian nationalism or whatever it is, it's just so beyond the reality of what it was. It was in some ways a very progressive system, an evil one, but a progressive one.
So where do we start as a typical turning point as to when the Weimar started to fail and the mustachioed failed artist wanted to make his move? Like, what do you think, in your opinion, is the exact point that you would, is that the 1920s, 1929, the collapse of the capitalist system in the West?
Yeah, I think certainly the crash of 29 was a huge part of it. The fact that the United States and Great Britain, I mean, look, the U.S. did a whole lot to help rebuild Germany and Europe after the war. Unfortunately, some of the loan situations that had been worked out in the early 20s didn't work out very well after the crash. And, you know, you saw this in Germany and Japan and Italy, a lot of these countries that came to rely on sort of Anglo-American capitalism to lift them up, felt like they were let down, they were betrayed. And I think that created a lot of this idea that the real villains, the sinister villains, were Great Britain, the United States, and of course for Adolf Hitler, this was all some Jewish conspiracy. So I think that did build a lot of antipathy toward the capitalist system. They blamed the capitalists in Great Britain, the United States, for their troubles. You saw this in Japan too. So I do think the crash of 29, the depression, was a major turning point, and that people felt that the capitalist democratic system was a failure and that something new was going to come and replace it, that maybe some kind of form of authoritarianism was actually superior to the capitalist system, which felt to many to be empty, hollow. Many saw it as not just failed economically, but failed morally too. And so I think that that's what opened up the opportunity. And I think what sort of delivered one of the few death blows to the Weimar Republic, where people basically gave up. And of course you had hyperinflation and all kinds of deep economic troubles during that time. And that opens up the door to some other form of government, such as some kind of authoritarianism. I mean, it even did within the United States. You could say that there was a dramatic change in the 1930s under the New Deal of Franklin Roosevelt compared to the old Republic. There was a dramatic change in the constitutional system. So, you know, that crisis, I think, was a turning point in global history.
That's a very interesting parallel. I mean, when people talk about how the 1930s changed the Weimar Republic to Nazi Germany, they don't really mention that, yes, in America, the old Republic also died literally with the New Deal and all that. So here we have this country, which is probably the most powerful economic country in Central Europe. Obviously, numerically, it's the biggest country in the European continent. You have the centrist powers all collapsed. The Social Democrats no one likes the Social Democrats anymore because they couldn't control oil prices. They couldn't control inflation. You know, their currencies, like toilet paper, everyone is using them as toilet papers. There is massive disorder on the streets. People are fighting. Their properties are being taken off, rape happening on a massive scale. The right wings and the left wings, well, the right wings are not really that coalesced around one single party, but there are right-wing gangs, which are like local, you know, they're conservative gangs. There are some right-wing gangs which wants to just save property. They're like local vigilante groups. And then you have this organized communist movement. And then you have art, which is, neo-objectivism and, you know, post-modernist art in Weimar Republic. What led to the rise of the thing that catalyzed all of these things to one movement, the stab in the back myth? Like, what do you think is your opinion? Like, how did that come into being?
Yeah, you know, that's actually a complicated question, because it's interesting because Hitler came to these conclusions, despite the fact that as a young man, didn't seem, certainly when he was serving in the German military during the war, didn't seem to be deeply anti-Semitic. At least there's no real evidence of that. His commander was actually a Jewish man who, of course, was actually baptized as Protestant, so he wasn't Jewish, but he had Jewish parents and grandparents. So so on a face, but say, well, why did this man turn to anti-Semitism? But I think that, like many times in history, I think Jews have been targeted because they oftentimes are seen as a separate group within society. Jews are often targeted. I mean, heck, I think we're even seeing that a little bit today in Western countries and throughout the globe. The Jews have always had special targeting and attention. I think, unfortunately, in continental Europe and Germany, there has been a long tradition of anti-Semitism that does run very deep. Now, of course, in Germany of the 1920s and 1930s, many, you could say most Jews were very deeply assimilated into German society. I think that's actually one of the most horrifying things for many Jews who made it through the period thereafter, was this idea that you could be so deeply assimilated into a society and have them turn on you. I mean, you may not even identify as Jewish. You may not be religiously Jewish, but you'll be targeted for who and what you are. And I think that the Germans were looking for, I think, in those days, for excuses for why the war was a failure. I think that it's because they didn't see the Western armies, the armies of France and Britain, the United States, literally marching into Berlin. There was this feeling that, well, we couldn't possibly have lost in the field. We had won so many battles. We had obviously, we'd had them beaten, but somehow we gave up. Even though, obviously, when you look at the statistics, when you look at the economics, when you look at the situation, as you explained, the manpower situation, Germany's position was hopeless in 1918, yeah. Completely and utterly hopeless. If they weren't defeated in 1918, then they would be by 1919. There would have been a march straight into Berlin. But that's right. I think it became a very convenient myth, and Jews became the target of that myth. I think it was a very convenient scapegoat for Germany's ultimate failure in the war, and unfortunately turned into something very, very, very ugly, and something that had happened in many other European countries. The pogroms that existed in Eastern Europe and Russia had been terrible in previous centuries. I think, unfortunately, a lot of German Jews didn't quite realize how bad it would be until it was too late.
I have an interesting theory as to why it just suddenly spread so much so fast. So if you see the history of that period, one, when Ludendorff was organizing the peace treaty after the First World War, he was like, okay, so, you know, we need to have every single individual who has supported the peace to be in the government. Now, in Ludendorff's mind, it was that he didn't think of them as Jews or anything of that. So it was like, these are the people who are pacifists and they're socialists, they're cultural Marxists, you know, in the 1930s term. And they have created this situation, so they have to be in the place to establish peace and then figure out what to do with it. We don't have anything to do, you know, from what comes after the war is stopped. So he did it in a very hands-off noble way, in a way. Like, you know, we are the nobility, Hindenburg and Ludendorff, we are like old-school German conservatives. We have nothing to do with the peace. We didn't support the peace. We didn't advocate for the peace. Now that you guys want peace, you figure it out what happens after that. It's kind of like David Cameron leaving after Brexit. It's like, you know, I didn't support Brexit, so I'm not going to be the one managing after Brexit. So that's a very classic conservative position. What created because of that is, you rightly mentioned, there were hundreds and thousands of Jewish people who actually fought for Germany, and they were extremely patriotic. In fact, A.G.P. Taylor said the Jews were actually the most loyal of Austrians and Germans, because to them, they were not Germans by ethnicity, or they were not Austrians by ethnicity. They were like, we are the member of the Austro-Hungarian Empire or the German Empire. We are the most loyal subjects. So they saw that two things simultaneously happened. On one hand, the German society was like, okay, Ludendorff and Hindenburg and all these noble people who are leading us to war, they are backing off, which means they have been, you know, they have been taken away from power. So someone is like, you know, destroying them from behind. And you, as you mentioned, like, they had no idea, because they were under so much thorough propaganda that they thought they would win the war the day before the war ended. So they were, it's kind of like a shock. Like, okay, how did we even lose the war? There's this bad that armies are not marching. You know, it's an armistice. We're just stopping to fight. Why? I mean, we are a powerful country. We are the Germans. We are, like, you know, the top power of Europe. We destroyed Russia. Then how are we losing to these people in the West? On the other hand, the Germans east of Germany and the civilizations east of Germany were far more anti-Semitic. So the more Germany started to acquire power post the coming of the Nazis, the more it turned anti-Semitic by degree. Like, I think that's because initially when it started, like, Goebbels, for example, was extremely anti-Semitic, but there were other Nazis, for example, who were ambivalent, if not, I mean, yeah, they harbored, like, ill intentions towards the Jews, but they were not, like, you know, mechanized about that we need to, like, call all of these people or anything of that sort. But the more they acquired power, it's kind of like the Hannah Arendt's, you know, the evil is banal theory, which I personally subscribe to. I do think majority of the evil in a society happens because most normal people are midwits, and they just, you know, they do stuff that they're told to do. And, you know, and that's essentially what we saw in during the COVID period, is like, fundamentally, people don't really think much. Oh, the authority has told us to do things, that must be good for us. So once Germany started to kind of, like, acquire the momentum of rearming, it just started increasing. The anti-Semitism just, like, blasted into open, and, you know, it came into power.
You know, I will have to throw out one thing. COVID, I remember somebody saw somebody walking around New York with a shirt that was said that I believe in fascism, and it was not worn ironically. Yeah. This person really, it was like, the shirt basically says, like, I'm for fascism. It said fascism, and I thought that was quite amusing. So it's interesting that you bring up.
They were worshipping candles, and the interesting thing about Arendt's, you know, banality of evil, the thing is, it's such a profound idea that evil spreads because people don't think. You know, they are just, I'm an officer, I go to work, not a normal guy, you know, I just do things that I'm told to do. I don't really think much. I believe science, I believe the good people, the smart, the experts, you know. It's just, it's incredible.
Yeah, it's interesting to me, because I think you're right that there was a longer tradition of anti-Semitism in the East. And I think this was actually very true with a lot of Russian Jews in the early days of the Third Reich.
Ukrainians.
Getting out of Dodge. Yes, yes.
Ukraine absolutely had some of the worst pogroms. People don't remember that. I mean, there is a reason why the Ukrainian nationalists were so Nazi.
Yeah, you know, it's there were a lot. There's a reason that there were so many Jews from Eastern Europe coming to the United States in the 1880s and 1890s, including some of my own family members who got out of Odessa when things were getting quite terrible there.
But these things
were just, like, common. You know, every generation or two, this is what would happen. Some of the pogroms were absolutely terrible. And so that was, you know, so they saw the signs happening in Germany. I think for the Eastern European Jews, it was like, well, here it is, here it comes, we got to get out. And I think, but for a lot of German Jews, that wasn't necessarily the case. They just couldn't quite believe that this modern state would become this engine of death that would basically create the most vicious pogrom in human history. I think it was beyond people's conception in the 1930s when this began to where it ended up with death camps in the 40s.
It's also interesting because Germany was such a mixed society that they had to have rules about measuring like blood drops and you know all that kind of stuff because they were intermarriages. They were there. It's an extremely assimilated society compared to, for example, Ukraine, where like people don't they never intermarry. So, for example, when there was a pogrom happening in Ukraine, the Ukrainian nationalists could just go to places where the Jews lived and just burned everything down without thinking that half of these people might be married to my brother or my sister. In Germany, it was a different situation. Half the people were, you know, stunned to leave, like Einstein, you know, all of these smart people who thought that Germany is such a civilized, aristocratic, good power of Europe. Like, how can these people who have got the highest per capita education system in the world, the most scientific country in the world, be also so ridiculously evil? And they never made the 2+2, that because they are so scientific and because they are so disciplined is the reason they never really questioned any alternative theory. Like, the questioning authority would be a sign of low class.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't want to get too much off Germany here, but I will say that the ethnic conflicts in Ukraine and Eastern Europe, this is actually, there's a very good movie called Hatred. I think it came out in 2016 that deals with the kind of ethnic conflict. Because you're right, there was more of a delineation between the various ethnicities and you could say religion too, yeah, in that part of Europe that made it, I mean, where you had during World War II when society and governments broke down, you basically had rival ethnic gangs going over to the next village and butchering everybody they could see. And it was, yeah, you know, there's a reason why they called that region the Bloodlands. And it wasn't just because the armies marched through. It was because gangs of vicious people hated each other. And so that was very common on Eastern Europe, less common in places like Germany. So I wanted to get around to this question. I think it is an important one as this kind of lead up to World War II is, you know, why is it that Germany was so strong in the early days of World War II and had so many victories? I mean, why was it, especially, I mean, Germany had lost World War I. It had been defeated. It had been put down by, you could say, the Versailles Treaty. You had essentially an alliance that was created to keep Germany down. And yet in 1940, the German armies swept away France in a way that was unthinkable in the First World War, where France fought Germany essentially to a standstill over many years. How is it that Germany went from being a broken, dysfunctional society, a Weimar society, one that where you had hyperinflation, one where they had been broken up, to one that was at one point, especially in the early days of World War II, the master of continental Europe? How did that happen?
Yeah, I mean, we are going to discuss this in the war episode more thoroughly. But to bring to your question, fundamentally, Germany was a major power. I mean, there is no question about it. It numerically, by manpower, it was the biggest country in Europe. It still is, technically, in some ways. It's the biggest economy. After the First World War, they had punitive measures on top of them where, you know, they had to pay indemnity and all that kind of stuff. But the majority of the German production, steel and coal, were still in German hands. They couldn't rearm or remilitarize the borderlands between France and Germany, but they could produce and outproduce, essentially, France. So that's one of the things, in my opinion. Second, the entire 1930s, Germany was clandestinely rebuilding weapons, whereas on one hand, Britain was like, we have had a horrible war. We are not going to war in Europe. I mean, British isolationism, which was actually genuine isolationism compared to America, was back. Britain was traditionally a power which never wanted to interfere in Europe. And the last time they interfered in the First World War, they lost hundreds and thousands of people. It was in the psyche of British people. People blame Chamberlain, but he was doing exactly what his people wanted him to do at that point of time. Third, in the 30s, with the Anschluss, with the addition of the Sudetenland, with the, you know, Czechoslovakia inside Germany, all the German, with Danzig coming back to Germany, the manpower and the production capacity of Germany increased tenfold. Like, they literally took over the entirety of Central Europe without anyone doing anything about, you know, about that. Whereas Britain, for example, was tied up in various parts. In India, there was this nationalist movement happening. Japan was rising. So there was this entire, you know, British Navy in Singapore. And finally, the techniques that France and Britain had in the First World War, they thought, oh, we won because of these techniques. We would just have a defensive line and we're going to win again. They never really understood that the war techniques had changed so much when it comes to the German maneuvering. The military machine that Germany had was very, very different.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think that, and I actually think that Germany, that the manpower issues and all that, I think that actually still existed until the very eve of the war. And this is maybe something that we'll get more into in the next episode where we talk about Churchill and Chamberlain in the United States. But I think there were, in the years before World War II, especially in the mid-30s to even the late 30s, until literally just before the war, I don't think Germany was that strong. In fact, I think that especially when Germany occupied the Rhineland and France essentially didn't do anything, I think had there been an intervention at that point, I think it's possible that a larger conflict may have been averted, because at that point, Germany still didn't have its manpower, didn't have the industries that it was able to acquire when it acquired large parts of Czechoslovakia, when it acquired Austria, when it acquired these regions that had many more people. And I think this is what you see, and this is again why Adolf Hitler became so popular, is that he acquired all of these things without lifting a finger. It seemed all he had to do was do the saber rattling, and he got his way time after time. And I think that there was a misunderstanding of the nature of Adolf Hitler from a lot of leaders within Europe. That's, I guess, again, we'll be getting more into this in our episode about Churchill. But I think just a misunderstanding of the psychology of the man. This man was a fanatic. He was a man that was driven, and that war was unfortunately coming to Europe because of the nature of this individual, the nature of the German regime, and the nature of the people. I think you can see in the lead up to the war. And I think, I guess you could say it is unfortunate that there wasn't that moment in which France and Britain decided to intervene in what was happening with Germany, which they had the right to do under the treaty. I mean, under the Treaty of Versailles, they did. But Germany, I think, of course, kept its officer corps intact in the interwar period. They very cleverly worked. Unfortunately, they worked with the Soviet Union to help rebuild their military, which I think was very much intentional on the part of the Soviet Union. I think that's an underrated part of the war, is how much the Soviet Union was really complicit in driving events toward a massive global war. I think a little bit too much credit is given toward the Germans for starting the war. And I think, unfortunately, the Soviets were a huge part of the war becoming what it was. Very intentionally, because they wanted to see Europe plunge into chaos so that they could march their armies in after all the destruction had been done. But unfortunately, the warning signs for Germany's rise were there for many years. And by the time that the tanks rolled into Poland, the planes flew over Poland, you could say it was sort of too late. I mean, it was already over. As you said, the French doctrine was not able to keep up. The German manpower was at that point immense. And their war industries were at full capacity. And so as the war starts, you know, Germany is able to deliver a knockout blow to France that really shocks the world.
I agree broadly, but I also have a slight amount of sympathy to the other side of the argument, in the sense, like, one, for example, so there is this question, which is still not, like, it's still debated in a way, as most of the questions in international relations and history, as to why did Britain intervene when it comes to Poland and why not Czechoslovakia? Czechoslovakia was a more liberal country. It was fundamentally Bohemia. Like, it's the most liberal country in Europe for centuries. Poland was arch conservative. Poland was Catholic. Czechoslovakia was not Catholic. It was Protestant. So why did Britain intervene when it comes to Poland and why not Czechoslovakia? So, I mean, where I fall in this question is, one, Danzig, for example, which is Gdansk in Poland now, was fundamentally a German place. So when Germany took it back, you know, it was essentially kind of like, oh, the Germans wanted to just go back to Germany. Fair enough. Same with Austria. If you talk to Austrians, they're going to say, like, oh, we never wanted to align with Germany. But at that point of time, they actually wanted to be part of the German-speaking world. I mean, they were very happy that the German unification happened without any war. You know, they were throwing flowers when the troops marched in. Czechoslovakia is a different question. France and Britain could have intervened, and France actually wanted to intervene. But two things happened. One, France wouldn't go to war without Britain on its side, given how close they were to defeat in the First World War. And second, to British, you know, politicians, they were not prepared for war. And secondly, they were thinking like Poland and France on two sides of Germany are still two big powers. It's going to take some time for Germany to kind of like, no one expected the German army to just wipe over France within 3 months. They were thinking like, if Germany starts a war, it's going to invade Poland, it's going to face resistance, and then it's going to invade France, and there will be a steady war going on for quite some time, and we're going to build up production. So I think there was this miscalculation when it comes to France and Britain as to like the timing of the war as well. I don't think anyone had an appetite to go to war when Germany took over Austria or Danzig, because to them it was Germany. You know, it was just Germany coming back to Germany.
I agree with you entirely about Czechoslovakia, and that was, I think it was Chamberlain who I think even said to the French, you know, basically, well, how much were you willing to offer in defense? He said, you know, right, basically like two divisions. You know, it's like, well, that's not going to stop the German army, two divisions. And when you look at Czechoslovakia, I mean, that's where there's a lot of heavy industry. There's the Skoda Works, which was very famous, and the German war machine was largely fueled by a lot of what they took in Czechoslovakia, a country that was unfortunately in a situation that it couldn't fight Germany alone. Just geographically, it couldn't fight Germany alone. It needed the support of France and Britain to fight a war in what would have been a very serious war. I don't think that it could have been that the Germans could have just marched into Czechoslovakia if France and Britain had indeed gone to war. By the time Poland rolls around, it's too late. I mean, it's already a foregone conclusion what's going to happen. It's really in the Czechoslovakia where you see the kind of betrayal, and it's something that was necessary for the balance of power, and absolutely necessary is keeping Czechoslovakia an independent country, keeping that manpower and industry out of the hands of Germany. Once it had that, I think that war unfortunately seemed to be nearly inevitable at that point.
Yeah, I sort of agree. I mean, I do think the war was inevitable anyway. I mean, that's, we are going to discuss in the book recommendations anyway. Like, I strongly agree with the structural argument that it would have been a war regardless of who was in power in Germany. So, yeah.
So, I guess it is time to get to the book recommendation part of this episode. So, I'll just let you go into it. What's your book recommendation? I've been waiting for this. I'm waiting for it.
Yeah, okay. I'm gonna avoid the normal. I would strongly recommend my favorite historian of all time, Alan John Percival Taylor. His magisterial work on the start of the Second World War is build up of the Second World War. I mean, we are obviously going to discuss the Second World War in great detail in two episodes, but the build up of the war, I think that's one of the greatest books you'd probably read. The other book I would recommend is someone who has fallen off the favor for a bit recently for his socialist leanings, but at that point of time he fundamentally understood why the peace wouldn't last. It's Edward Hallett Carr, E.H. Carr's 20 Years Crisis, where he said that, you know, this is liberal idealism. We are not going to stop Germany from coming back to power, and there will be a second war. And he was right. He was right on both counts.
Yeah, both excellent recommendations. So my recommendation is actually going to be a biography of Hitler that was written a few years ago by Brendan Sims. It's called Hitler, A Global Biography. I think it's an excellent book, and it makes an interesting contention that Adolf Hitler's main fear was not the Soviet Union, was really the Anglo-American powers. He was worried about America's growing demographic strength of the size and scope, and of course Great Britain, the financial power, and that was really what drove Hitler, of course, to underestimate the Soviet Union very badly. But it's really an excellent biography, a modern biography. I will note one kind of amusing thing on the book. There's we're in the back of the book where most of the time you have endorsements and whatnot. The actual somebody screwed up in the PR department, because it actually has a line on the back that says, "Praise for Hitler. because it's trying to praise the book, which I find very amusing. But excellent book if you want a kind of a real modern biography about the kind of mentality of Adolf Hitler and the rise of Germany.
Didn't Sims was the guy who said in this book that fundamentally Hitler was opposed to capitalism in some ways? Like, I remember reading the book for a long time back, but he said something about Hitler's. Yeah,
that's basically the thesis of the book, that it was Hitler's opposition to bourgeoisie capitalism that drove his mentality, that he both hated and feared the Americans and the British, and saw that as the cause of all problems. And of course, linked this to the Jews, as everything came down to the Jews. But this was all kind of linked together in his mentality. So it's an excellent psychological profile of Adolf Hitler, I think, from sort of a different perspective. So I think it's interesting. So I think that'll about do it on this week's episode of History Reconsidered. In future episodes, we'll be talking about Winston Churchill, Neville Chamberlain, and the United States in the lead up to World War II. Thank you very much.